from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour on Tuesday, a high Israeli military official accused Syria of using chemical weapons against rebels, citing reports of victims foaming at the mouth and showing other symptoms associated with chemical weapon use. President Obama has said chemical weapons would be crossing a red line and be a game changer, and he indicated that the United States would respond. The United States also just doubled its aid to Syrian rebels, pledging to give $123 million in body armor and other supplies. We'll hear the latest news and discuss America's options as the Syrian civil war and even greater casualties continue. Forum is next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry announced that the United States would be doubling aid to the rebel fighters in Syria, including body armor, armored vehicles, and other military supplies. Meanwhile, the British and the French, as well as more recently an Israeli brigadier general, have indicated that there is evidence of the Syrian Alawite dictatorial regime of Bashar al-Assad using chemical weapons against the rebels. And President Obama, you may remember, said that that would be a red line and a game changer. And we have some breaking news, which I want to get forthwith here. But in the opening hour, we're actually turning our attention full bore on once again to Syria, which, by the way, had worse casualties yet being reported. First, we want to go to New York City and welcome Deborah Amos, who Middle Eastern correspondent for National Public Radio. And Deb Amos, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I guess first things first here, breaking news, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has said, yes, they are using chemical weapons. And does that mean the red line and, well, the responsiveness from this administration will be forthcoming?
24 hours ago, Chuck Hagel said unproven suspicions when he was in Israel. He's in Abu Dhabi. Now he says the Syrian government has used chemical weapons against its people. In fact, the White House sent out two letters to Senators John McCain and Carl Levin that said that they believe that there is some evidence that they have found, U.S. government sources have found themselves, that show that there has been sporadic use of chemical weapons. If you read the letters, it doesn't appear that some change of policy is imminent. And I think that we have to wait to see how this develops. The fact that we've seen such a change in the way that the administration is talking about chemical weapons, they may be thinking about it, but no policy change yet.
Well, the president's used some pretty strong rhetoric here. You know, this will be a game changer and we will have to respond. And there's even been talk about what kind of response, which we'll go into in the course of this hour. But he's kind of backed himself in a corner here where it almost seems likely that he will have to do something.
Not necessarily. That red line has been changing. It was pretty, you know, the statement was very broad when he first made it. If they use it, we will respond. It has moved a bit over time about the definition of using. For the moment, we are looking at four instances from January to April. This is what the Israeli intelligence people have been talking about. The British and the French have been talking about. These are not mass casualties. These are not neighborhood, you know, weapons of mass destruction kind of use. It may be that that red line has changed, and we will have to see what the White House does and how they decide that they are going to interpret this policy.
Well, this came most recently. You mentioned the French and the British. It came most recently from a brigadier general, Israeli, who's high up in intelligence. And yet it doesn't seem to be full agreement here where Israel is concerned. In fact, Bibi Netanyahu has not necessarily come on board on this. And recently, in fact, I wanted to talk about breaking news. We just got a story out of Israel that says they shot down a drone from Lebanon. It's hard to sort out what Israel may see in its best interests here, because certainly they are not fans of the Assad regime, and they probably are not necessarily they've been taking a pretty neutral position because they don't know who the rebels are.
That was curious that you saw Israel's top military intelligence analysts say that he was confirming that the Assad regime had used sarin And you saw the prime minister say, well, I'm not really sure, which left our Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, lots of room to be able to say unproven suspicions. He wasn't, it was as if he was given, a way out of making a policy declaration when he was in Israel. However, 24 hours later, we see a much harder statement with the Secretary of Defense. I think that Israel has not, it seems to me, has not exactly decided how dangerous this Syria is for them. Certainly, they are worried mostly about Jordan. Jordan is being overwhelmed by refugees, so strained that it is, we are talking about questions of stability in the kingdom. You have one refugee camp with 126,000 people, the fourth largest city in Jordan that didn't exist a year ago. And there are 2,000, 4,000 crossing the border every day. So Israel has a couple of things to watch. Lebanon is only one of the destabilizing states that they're watching.
We're talking, by the way, with Deborah Amos, if you've just joined us, Middle East correspondent for NPR. And now we've also got more aid going to the rebels. They're claiming that it's non-lethal aid, but there's aid coming from a number of other quarters that the United States may be involved in, and saying it's humanitarian aid, but yet it's increased. And as I said in my introduction, we've got certainly things that lend themselves to battle. We've got military supplies and armored vehicles and so forth. And at this point, do you anticipate, Deborah, that that will increase even more?
It's hard to say. For the moment, it appears that the Washington strategy is we arm the rebels not for them not to win, but to pressure the Assad regime to negotiate. And so there's always going to be a limit on the amount of aid that is going to go to those rebels if the strategy is to support them as far as pressuring Assad. I think that the regime is taking this new policy actually more seriously than the rebels are. You can see them beginning to change their strategy a bit. They think that there is going to be a stream of new kinds of weapons coming in from the south, and they are planning accordingly. I don't think it will be that much more than is being supplied at the moment, and it is still in the non-lethal realm, more on the military side than it has been. We are talking about flak jackets, night goggles, more intelligence, but it's still not the kind of weaponry that the rebels need to win.
Well, you talk about the Assad regime perhaps having more pressure on it. New York Times had a cover story this morning. I just want to tell listeners, you've probably seen it, Deb, about the Assad government campaign to essentially scare the West into switching sides because they feel that the West is moving more toward the rebels. And they put out a parade of jihadis and extremists and said, this is what you have to deal with. These were captured, of course, from the rebel side. And it would seem that they're also letting more foreign journalists in to sort of take observation of this sort of thing, this promotional campaign that they're putting on.
They've been doing it all along. I had four legal visas over the course of this revolution. Now, what you're seeing and why you're noticing it is because the New York Times got into Syria. That's what's unusual. The BBC has been in and out, British newspapers, French newspapers, and certainly there's been some extraordinary coverage from Russian TV stations. They have been embedded with the Syrian army. And so if you look at Russian TV, you see extraordinary footage as the army goes into some of these towns. But letting the New York Times in, that's a big deal. So now you are seeing it on the front page of, the preeminent newspaper in America. It does seem like they are letting more reporters in. And I think what that means is more American reporters.
And is it fair to say at this point that we really don't know who these rebels are? I mean, there's Salafists, there's secularists, there's Muslim Brotherhood, there's Wahhabis. It's just such a strange and wide range of diversity in terms of those who are the combatants.
I think we do. And look, early on in the conflict, a young researcher named Joe Halliday at the Institute of the Study of War did the first major study and told people exactly who the rebels were. And there's been others, Andrew Tabler, Jeffrey White. There's a guy who runs a blog.
Yeah, forgive me. I've seen some of these pieces. There's been a lot more radicalization, though, because of the lack of support from the West, too.
That is absolutely true. That has to be factored in. However, we do know who the defected soldiers are, what units they're in. And so you can't really say we don't know. We do. It is true that the radicalization has come because those who are backing that agenda have been far more generous in supplying weapons than Western allies who say they want the regime to fall but do not put their money where their policy is. And so there are many Syrians who have been radicalized simply because they go where the weapons are.
And can you give us a quick update on the casualties? We're reading from reports that they're getting worse than ever. And notwithstanding what may be chemical weaponry being used, are they indeed increasing?
Well, we had what many activists are calling Black Sunday. It was an astonishing number, more than 500 in a day. What was I found interesting in that story is it barely reached headlines in the Syrian coverage. It's as if we're all waiting for the chemical weapons story and don't sort of take into account that when you kill 500 people on one day, that is an extraordinary and terrible thing. The chemical weapon, those who are suspected of actually being exposed to chemical weaponry, those numbers are quite low. I spoke to a doctor this morning. He's on the Turkish side of the border. He's treating 20 patients. He suspects that they were exposed to some sort of chemical weapons in a neighborhood around Aleppo, Sheikh Massoud. This is an interesting part of this story. It's a Kurdish neighborhood. In that community, chemical weaponry is very sensitive. These were people who were gassed by Saddam Hussein in a town called Halabja. And so they wanted to be sure that this was documented. They have been taking soil samples out of Sheikh Massoud into Turkey, passing them off to anybody who can get them to a lab. But you know, we are talking about 20 victims as opposed to 500 last Sunday.
But there's also documentation, in addition to what you just mentioned, from the suburbs of Damascus and from Homs, as well
yes.
as Aleppo. So this is all on the record with the French and the British. And it's a developing, ongoing story. It's just difficult, obviously, to verify and hard to prove conclusively. That's the challenge. Deb Ramus, so good to have you with us on Forum. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you very much. Thank
Deb
you
Ramus,
for having me.
Again, is Middle East correspondent for National Public Radio. Well, we've got a number of experts here to talk about the ongoing crisis in Syria. Joining us by phone is Gregory Koblenz, who is a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Amir Al-Azam back here on Forum, Associate Professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Professor, good to have you back.
Thank you. Glad to be there, too.
And we also have Professor Stephen Zunis back with us, Professor of Politics and Chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, Senior Analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Welcome back, Steve Zunis.
Good to be here again.
Good to have you. Gregory Koblenz, let me begin with you just sort of to get some overview from your perspective and from what you've been able to ascertain. Let's just talk first about things like sarin gas and some of the chemical weapons we're talking about here. The symptoms are a problematic bar in terms of judging the effects or verifying the effects and making them incontrovertible. Not to say that symptoms aren't tied to effects. What I mean by that is getting to the real root of proving definitively that that chemical weapons are being used. It is a high bar, and it's difficult to prove, isn't it?
That's correct. There are a number of difficulties proving allegations of the sort we've been hearing about. Looking at the symptoms of the victims isn't always indicative because some of these symptoms are very nonspecific. Things like eye pain, blurred vision, headache, nausea, that could be caused by lots of other either chemicals or non-chemical sources. So just relying on eyewitness reports or even medical reports isn't necessarily going to be sufficient. You need some stronger evidence in the form of samples from the environment, ideally some ammunition or fragments from ammunition that has chemical residue on it that can be tested to be shown that it has actual sarin or VX or some other chemical warfare agent on it.
Well, they've been using soil samples, as we heard earlier. But the Syrians asked the United Nations to investigate the use of chemical attacks against them last month near Aleppo.
That's correct. The Syrians were the first to request the UN to investigate, and the UN promptly put together a team. They are now sitting in Cyprus, and they've been waiting to enter into Syria, but because they haven't been allowed in yet, because they've also want to investigate reports from non-governmental sources, from the rebel groups, about the use of chemical weapons in Syria. And so the Syrian government hasn't allowed them in for fear that they'll investigate these other claims as well.
Well, there are a lot of chemical weapons in Syria that we know. There are stockpiles of sarin and sulfur mustard and VX chemicals, which you mentioned, to be used as warfare agents. One of the difficulties is they're pretty spread out. There's at least a dozen of them, and they're spread out all over the place, which prompts me to ask you, what kind of response, if the United States did indeed decide to go into a reactive mode to this and follow through on the rhetoric that we've heard from President Obama, I suppose they could increase non-lethal help or, for that matter, go to lethal help or sanctions. There's a limited number of things they could do, really, isn't there?
Yeah, there's actually a wide variety of responses the administration could pursue, both on its own and with its allies, ranging, like you said, from increasing aid, lethal and non-lethal aid to the rebels, sanctions, both unilateral and through the United Nations Security Council, all the way up to creating safe havens or no-fly zones or even limited military strikes against Syria's chemical weapons stockpile. So depending on how confident the administration is in the evidence and depending how much of a threat the chemical weapons pose, there are a number of different options the U.S. and its allies can pursue.
And those would include, in a more serious vein, missile strikes from the Mediterranean or commando raids, I presume.
That's certainly a possibility. Given the size and the how dispersed the Syrian chemical stockpile is, it would be extremely hard to be able to secure it all using special forces or military units. So that would really have to be part of some larger military operation. But certainly the use of air power and cruise missiles would be one option. But then you have the risk that the strikes on these targets will wind up releasing these chemicals into the communities and the areas, causing even more civilian casualties. So just, you know, deciding to order an attack on these sites is not that simple at all.
Well, Professor Amar al-Azam, let me bring you into this. It seems, from your perspective, unlikely that President Obama's administration are going to act to intervene in Syria, and there's a lot of bark here other than bite.
Well, that's been the case all along, in that the administration, if I remember correctly, way back in 2011 when the Syrian uprising began, I think it was in end of July 2011, President Obama said Bashar al-Assad must go, and nothing happened. So, and that must have been quite a shock, you know, because when the President of the United States says something like that and it doesn't sort of take effect, then there's a problem there. And then when we come to the chemical weapons and the red line, again, the red line was drawn in the sand, and it seems that the red line has this ability to shift. And what's important here is to remember and understand that the Assad regime itself has has read U.S. policy and the intentions of the White House quite clearly and quite well, and has adapted its own strategies accordingly. And so we see this constant sort of testing of where the red line is, and this ability to essentially cross the red line, because Assad believes, and we have evidence of this, very recently there was a meeting, I think it was on Sunday, there was a meeting in Damascus of pro-Syrian Lebanese government officials, in which Assad said, don't worry, the Americans ultimately are pragmatic and they have no intention of really sort of engaging in Syria, so essentially we can do what we want.
Well, let's assume that Assad is wrong about that. What would the nature of the intervention be, or what should it be from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, I've always said that what the United States needs to do is a clear demonstration of what is acceptable and unacceptable. You know, when you put a red line in the sand, you also have to have in place the mechanism to enforce that. If you don't have that mechanism and it's not ready and you're not prepared to use it, then you shouldn't go around putting red lines in the sand or otherwise. In my opinion, taking out, for example, the Scud launch pads, everybody knows where they're launched from. They're launched primarily from a major military base called Qatayfi, which is just outside Damascus on the north road heading towards Homs. Dropping a few cruise missiles on that, the next time a Scud missile is fired from there on a civilian target in the north or in Raqqa or wherever else, would send a clear and unequivocal message. It would be a very powerful demonstration to the regime that we are serious about when we say no means no. And the same could be done to the airport, same as some of the military airports. Then, and I believe, I've always said this, that if the regime were to receive such a demonstration, this would have very serious consequences on the willingness and the will, let's say, if not of the Assad themselves and the Assad family, but certainly those who carry out the orders, they would be recalculating their situation and thinking, oh, well, then things are not quite as simple as they are. Things are not as clear-cut. The Americans are not as pragmatic as we thought they are. We better start looking at other options. And the option that we in the United States would like them to look at is to come to the negotiating table and have serious negotiations that will lead to a political transition without the Assad.
Professor Amr Al-Azam, again, as Associate Professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State, and Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and Chair of Middle Eastern Studies Program at University of San Francisco. He's also Senior Analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Inadvisable to do what we just heard, Stephen Zunis?
I think so. I mean, I think as frustrating as it must be of witnessing the horror of the past couple of years, getting involved in a war, sending more arms to a disorganized, factionalized coalition of militias doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get any closer to victory. It'll mostly mean that more people will get killed. In many ways, it would be rewarding what I think was a seriously flawed strategic decision by the opposition to abandon the overwhelmingly nonviolent strategy, which brought in a huge proportion of the Syrian population, men, women, and children, general strikes that largely shut down the country, liberated whole areas of autonomous democratic zones. But now it's become an all against all, a civil war that's become increasingly factionalized, with radical Salafi groups gaining influence. Not because, despite what's been said earlier, because of that they're getting more arms than the more moderate factions, but just the radicalization that inevitably comes from many months of oppression and war.
But didn't we see a nonviolent attempt, to organize in Egypt, and it really failed? The Muslim Brotherhood came into power?
Oh, certainly. It's an ongoing struggle there, certainly.
Same thing in Syria. In fact, Syria has a more militant regime, one could argue, than even the Mubarak regime.
Well, Mubarak killed 800 people in a matter of 12 days of the uprising. So it wasn't like they responded in a passive manner whatsoever. We've also seen from Philippines to Poland, from Chile to Serbia, incredibly repressive regimes that have been brought down through strategic nonviolent action. Even places like East Germany and Tunisia, in fact, both Honecker and Ben Ali and Marcos in the Philippines as well. I could give other examples where they ordered their troops to gun down people in the thousands, and yet the troops refused. The people kept protesting, and the regimes fell.
Let's bring our listeners into this conversation. Where do you stand on Syria, your response to chemical weapons use, the red line, all of these things that we've brought up in this first half hour? You can join us now toll-free, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us, whether you're on radio listening or internet or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786, and you can be heard. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle @KQED Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour is on Syria, recent events and news stories coming out of Syria, as well as a statement we heard earlier from Deborah Amos, NPR's Middle East correspondent, about Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel now saying indeed there is evidence of the use of chemical weapons, which would seem to, move beyond the red line that President Obama had set up. But that red line seems to be moving. And we're also talking about the fact that more non-lethal weapons military assistance is going into Syria, night goggles and armored things of that sort. We're also finding out that there are more casualties than ever before. So the picture is widening and the civil war is continuing. We spoke with Deborah Amos. We also have with us in studio Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and chair of the Middle East Eastern Studies program at University of San Francisco. He is also senior analyst for foreign policy in Focus. And Professor Amar al-Azam, who is associate professor of Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Gregory Koblenz is also with us, Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow for the Council on Foreign Relations. And you can be with us as well. Again, if you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation or any questions or comments, feel free to join us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. Just read a couple of web comments here. Wayne writes on our website, "The terrorist jihadis that the USA flew into Syria from Libya and Saudi Arabia to fight Assad have been so vicious, hated, and incompetent that now the USA and its lapdog Israel are finally playing the trump card of accusing Assad of using chemical weapons, which is just another fabrication in a long list of fabrications. But taking the wild claims to the next level is a huge mistake. If we invade and Assad falls, actual terrorists will take over and civil society will perish, not to mention the rule of law. Such a move would risk a wider war since Russia and Iran stand behind Syria. Why worsen the Faustian bargain by cutting off the nose to spite the face?" Another web comment from Beth, who writes, "How about the United States start getting more concerned about the anti-USA folks who will become the new leaders when Syria falls? Or doesn't anyone pay attention to what happened in Egypt and in Libya?" Let me go to your calls. We'll begin with you, Bob, from San Jose. Good morning.
Hi. I'm struck by the parallel between Charlie Wilson's war back in the 80s, where we were helping the Mujahideen against the Russian occupation. We put a lot of weapons into them, and history shows what happened with that. Same thing happened to a lesser extent, although history hasn't played out yet, in Libya. So I want us to be careful what we wish for. The Bashar regime has clearly shown that they're bloody. But the alternative could be worse. The same thing happened. I mean, the alternative when Saddam left, the sectarian violence went off the scale, and the human cost is still being reckoned, and it's trillions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of lives.
Well, Bob, appreciate your comments, and we'll take it as a cautionary editorial note. I thank you for the call. I'm going to go right on to another caller from Houston. Michael, join us.
Thank you. I was actually in Syria a few years ago on a child kidnapping case. I've been in a television terrorism analyst. I thought what one of your guests said was actually a very good solution is to send some cruise missiles in, hit one of the military bases to send Assad a message to try to negotiate a settlement, because like the prior caller said, we don't want to have jihadis taken over, which might happen if things go as is, and yet we need to do something because Assad is murdering people at an alarming rate, and negotiate a deal might be the only way out.
Now, Michael, I thank you for that. Gregory Koblenz, what's your stand on that pragmatic point of view that we heard from Professor Amar al-Azam?
Well, I think the risk you run is that if you start using force against stopping Scud missile launches, then the question would go, well, why not stop the airplanes? And then why not stop the artillery? I think you need to have fundamentally a decision whether or not you want to intervene militarily in Syria and overtly and directly start backing the rebels against the Assad regime, or not. Going in with just that kind of very, very limited type of force, I don't think is going to be as productive as the professor thinks.
Well, but Professor Amaral-Azam, you're talking really about limited use of things like a cruise missile just to get them to the table and negotiate.
Yes. I mean, the reason why I basically we think that is because from very, very early on, we've had a lot of contact with people close to the regime, and we're trying to understand how the regime ticks and what would make the regime change its position. And one thing that we knew from quite early on and became very obvious is that the big, and this is, remember, this is 2011 when intervention in Libya, the events in Libya were still going on, and the biggest concern for those close to in the inner Assad circle was, will the U.S. invade? Will the international communities, do a Libya on us? And as soon as it became clear to them that this was not going to happen, you saw a huge escalation in the use of force by the regime.
Well, forgive me, Professor.
That got us where we are.
We didn't actually invade Libya. I mean, there were no boots on the ground.
I didn't mean invasion. I meant in terms of intervention by intervening in Libya, by providing the air cover, by providing the weapons. So they were thinking in terms of an intervention in the same way as that happened in Libya. But what needs to happen, and this is what's been missing, in that the regime has yet to see a demonstration of the real will of the international community to put an end to this. And as long as it doesn't see that, the regime will continue on its path, because in its own, if you want, in its own calculus, it considers itself to be safe and immune, because the international community in the United States actually needs Syria and needs Syria to basically ensure that the whole narrative of if the regime falls, it's going to be Salafists, it's going to turn into an al-Qaeda sort of hotbed, you're going to have another Afghanistan Taliban style. And this is something that the regime plays up on, and it actually fits into the regime's own narrative and what it's trying to push out. So it's very important to ensure that the regime is shown categorically and emphatically that there is a red line, and if you cross it, this is what's going to happen. And I think this will undermine the ability of the regime to give those orders to its troops, its commanders, to those close to it, and have them carried out. At the end of the day, what keeps a soldier from the Alawite villages up in the mountains in Damascus defending the right of the regime to claim to be the president, and Bashar al-Assad proclaimed to be the president of Syria? What keeps him there is the fact that he doesn't feel any real danger or any real threat to his existence. But when cruise missiles slam into one of their bases with the threat of more if certain actions are not done or if certain actions are pursued, then that soldier will think twice about following those orders, and that's when you start to have a breakdown, and that's when the regime will then seriously have to consider negotiation, because ultimately it is the decision and the policy of the United States to have a politically a political transition outcome for Syria, not a military one. We know that. We've known that all along. And actually, it is the better option. And I, as a member of the opposition, would prefer a politically negotiated transition out, which also includes the departure of the Assads, by the way.
Well, we have Stephen Zunis here shaking his head, and I need to bring his voice into this.
Right,
Stephen Zunis.
A number of things. First of all, the huge escalation in the killings came not when they became aware that the West would not intervene, but when the opposition took up arms, and they finally had an excuse to come down even harder than ever. And indeed, it was interesting during the first 6 or 8 months when the uprising was almost exclusively nonviolent, the regime had to manufacture claims of terrorism and Salafis and Western intervention, which was dismissed as a total fabric, totally bizarre, of course, as it was. I mean, I think one of a number of negative repercussions of the intervention in Libya, besides Mali, the Benghazi attacks, the rise of all these militias and that kind of thing, has been that it appears to have been one of the decisions that led the opposition to take up arms, thinking that the West would somehow come to their rescue. Now, there have been a number of empirical studies, most recently Erica Chenoweth at the University of Denver and others, that have looked at this so-called humanitarian intervention, and they have found that in the short term, it actually increases the repression because the regime no longer feels has anything to lose, and the opposition feels no reason to compromise. And indeed, we've seen most of the ceasefires that we've tried have been broken. Have actually been broken by the rebels, not by the regime. And this important point, I think, is that you talked about that Alawite soldier. I think what keeps him here, keeps him there, is that the regime has, for years, has manipulated the strong sense of nationalism that the Syrian people have.
Did you see Ali Lambert's film that was on Frontline?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
It certainly characterizes it.
Yeah, exactly. And unlike, much more so than Gaddafi or Bin Ali or Saleh or Mubarak, the regime has a social base, a minority, but a fairly sizable minority. And given the hostility the United States and the Western countries have had towards Syria, ranging from attacks on Syrian positions by the U.S. in the 1980s, the Syrian Accountability Act of 2003, the fact that the Bush administration pressured Israel to reject peace overtures by Assad back in 2007. These kind of things just play right into the hands of the regime. They were the last defender of the secular Arab nationalism, and the Western imperialists and the Islamists are teaming up to destroy us.
But you know what could happen here, and I just want to get your quick take on this, Stephen. You could find you have a Shiite regime in Iraq now that is not necessarily predisposed to be a friend of the West, and maybe even less apt, so the argument goes, to deal with terrorism against the West coming from a Shiite source. If you have a Sunni majority in Syria, the same thing could take place. It would be less apt to perhaps deal with the West in terms of stopping terrorism. There would be a possibility of extremists having control of chemical weaponry.
Yeah, that is a real possibility, and that's one of the concerns. That's why it's so critical that the impetus for the revolution, the impetus for the struggle of freedom, go back into civil society and not just the men with guns, which, as we've seen, not just in Islamic countries with hardline Salafis, but if you remember back during the Cold War, you know, you'd have broad-based progressive social movements, ends up the communist factions that tend to dominate because, again, they're the ones with the guns. And studies have shown that nonviolent movements that overthrow dictatorships most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, become new democracies, whereas armed groups that overthrow dictatorships, the vast majority of cases, become new dictatorships.
Sound like idealistic pipe dreaming to you, Amar al-Azam?
Yes, very much so. I'm sorry. I mean, I think he's got it wrong. The escalation in the violence and the death toll did not begin when the rebels took and the opposition took arms. That began before. If I recall, back in end of July and early August, the tank columns were driving down to Deir ez-Zor to basically take out Deir ez-Zor after they'd also finished Hama. The death toll was pretty significant. I was in Washington, D.C. at the time, and we were begging the State Department to actually just do one demonstration against that column of tanks, and everybody would go home. Just, I said, one Predator take out the lead tank, and we know that they would have turned around and gone home. That's how delicate it was then. But those were missed opportunities. And I can tell you also that most of us, if not all of us, and including myself, we all started off as peace activists, as civil activists. And gradually and surely, you ask us now, 2.5 years later, did we have a choice? No, we didn't. Yes, I know I know Erica's book, and I know what's inside, and I know the statistics. I'm familiar with them. I've read the book, too. It's great when it works. But we, you know, and there are failures on the part of the opposition. At the end of the day, 70% of the battle is getting everybody out. It didn't happen. The regime was too strong. People were too frightened. The regime was too brutal. Maybe there are other things we could have done before. But this is where we are now. And to somehow suggest that it's the opposition's fault, that the opposition just woke up one morning and decided to take up arms and shoot back at the regime for no good reason is I think, bogus and does not sit well with what we're trying to say here.
Let's bring on more of our callers. We've got some people who want to join the conversation. John, you're next. Good morning.
Morning. I'm just wondering, where is Iran in this conversation? This is the Bush administration, I think, missed the boat on taking the Ayatollah on our entry into Iraq for settling Hezbollah, among other things. I really feel, once again, we're missing a true pathway to peace and diplomacy and actually sitting down at the table and you know, bridging the gap between the nuclear issue. And instead, I see $10 million arms deals, you know, cozying up to the GCC and our kingdom allies and just further ratcheting up the tension between, you know, the Sunni and Shiite tensions in the region. So I'm wondering, have there been discussions with Iran to help camp?
Well, Iran and Syria have, of course, consistently and continue to back the Assad regime. But Gregory Koblitz, you're a nuclear security fellow. Would this be maybe even an opportunity to sit down and actually talk about nuclear stuff with Iran or move it in that direction?
Well, there
or break some of the neo-Cold War ice that we have with Putin?
Well, there have been a series of negotiations ongoing with Iran on the nuclear issue involving not just the U.S., but our European allies, Russia and China as well.
I'm thinking, though, about Syria being a linchpin. I'm taking the spirit of the caller's question here.
No, I understand. My point is that there have been these ongoing negotiations with Iran on the nuclear side, which have not gone well at all. So adding the Syrian civil war to the agenda, I think, would not really be productive. It would just further muddy the issue, since the U.S. and the British and the French have one set of feelings about what's going on in Syria, whereas Russia and China are much more supportive of the Syrian regime. So I don't think that would be a fruitful way to join those two issues and have progress on either one.
I ask a question from a listener, Gregory Koblenz, that you might be able to provide some light on. The question is, what's the full or as full as we can know story of CIA involvement in Syria post-World War II through today?
I'm not really familiar with that. I mean, I'm sure the Syria has been a target of the U.S. intelligence community for a long time. I don't think there is a full understanding of that.
Well, there's still a lot of bad blood with Syria. I mean, you know, it was labeled a terrorist state. The bombing of the Marine barracks took place. Many feel under Syria's stewardship or under Syria's watch. Many feel they provoked the war between Israel and Hezbollah. I mean, there's a lot of bad blood, and Syria also helped to a great extent in the war in Iraq. I mean, provide a lot of jihadists and a lot of those who went over the border to fight on the side of the Iraqi forces. I don't know how much this plays into it. Any thoughts on that, Gregory Koblenz?
I mean, certainly U.S.-Syrian relations have been extremely adversarial at times, but at the same time, the U.S. also engaged the Syrians fairly regularly as part of a bigger initiative on Middle East peace. Syria is one of the last countries on Israel's border not to sign a peace treaty with Israel. Syria and Israel still have outstanding territorial dispute about the Golan Heights. So the U.S., while it might object to certain Syrian policies and actions both domestically and abroad, has also found that it has to talk to the Syrians and work with them to resolve other issues that they're involved with. So there's always a balancing act between trying to achieve U.S. Objectives and at the same time working with them to on other issues as well.
And I'm looking at a tweet here that says it would have made sense to intervene in Syria had the U.S. not botched the Iraq invasion. The U.S. is scarred from over a decade of war. You want to add something here, Steve Yunus?
Yes, just very briefly on the CIA. The most significant legacy of the CIA in Syria was its apparent role in the coup in 1949, which overthrew the only real democratic government that Syria ever had. And it's been a series of coups and counter-coups during the 50s and 60s, and finally led to the consolidation of Assad and his son a little over 20 years later. But the thing I want to emphasize is that despite the hostilities towards Syria, there has been a lot of cooperation between the United States and Syria on some pragmatic levels. It's been the quietest border Israel has had for many decades. The U.S. later came out in opposition to Syria's role. The U.S. gave the green light for Syria's initial intervention in Lebanon in 1976, gave the go-ahead for Syria's role in the coup against General Aoun in December of 1990. Syria was a destination for the notorious Extraordinary Rendition Program, where suspected terrorists of Syrian origin were kidnapped by the United States, essentially, and sent there for torture, including an innocent Canadian man who was wrongfully identified as part of Al-Qaeda. And so, you know,
Syria was also occupying Lebanon, in effect. It may have been involved in the assassination of the head of
State. They've been doing all sorts of nasty things. But it's interesting how the U.S., when we switched and suddenly and finally came out against Syria's role and came down really hard, we really pushed the enforcement of UN Security Council Resolution 425. It was the justification for sanctions and much other things. When we ignored that same resolution vis-a-vis Israel. In fact, 425 was originally written about Israel. So after supporting Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon for 22 years, we suddenly flip and say, oh, this resolution suddenly has to be enforced. So that, in other words, what I'm saying is both in terms of our relationship with Syria and our grievances with Syria vis-a-vis other nations, there's a lot of double standards. It has not been a consistent policy whatsoever.
Also, in answer to the question that was raised, we had Mark Mazzetti on yesterday, who's written a book about the CIA, and there's documentation about the CIA being involved pretty much everywhere in the Middle East. Here's a listener who says, it's pretty clear we have to help get rid of Assad regime ASAP, or else more people will die, Jordan will be destabilized, and the jihadists will take over. We need to put in a no-fly zone, cruise missile, the chemical weapons sites. The Russians and the Iranians won't do anything to stop our support for the FSA. Strategically, it will benefit U.S. interests by getting rid of this regime. It will hurt Hezbollah, Iran, and the Russians and reduce their power in the region. And another listener writes on our Facebook page, Chuck Hagel said today in Egypt that there was no proof to support the Israeli claim that the Syrian government has used chemical weapons. Israel's constant fabrications and false flag operations like the USS Liberty and Operation Susanna are a few examples of many. The Likudnik neocons who use lies to invade Iraq are at it again to have the U.S. invade Syria and Iran. Another listener writes, small use of chemical weapons could be from rebels to incriminate Assad. They could have gotten the gas from sympathizers that can produce the gas on small scale. There needs to be a multi-country witnessing to the verification of chemical weapons that include countries other than the U.S., Britain, or affiliates, France and Israel. And let me go to more of your calls. Ahmadine, good morning.
Yes, hello. This is Ahmadine in San Francisco, and I was just wondering, wasn't the U.S. Responsible to the auspices of the CIA in installing the Assad's father, who was just as brutal a murderer as this President Assad is?
Yeah, I think Stephen Zunis was just alluding to that before.
And then I was actually talking about 1949. This was well before Assad. Assad was somewhat considered a little more was somewhat favored, I think, by the West relative to his predecessor. He was the one who blocked Syrian intervention in the Jordanian civil war earlier that year when he was head of the Air Force. But I've seen no evidence that the U.S. was responsible for Assad coming to power. In summary, let me say for the record, though I've certainly been critical of many American and Israeli policies in the region, I think it is really shameful to claim that somehow the United States and Israel is behind the uprising. It's a great disservice to the many thousands of Syrians who sacrificed their lives in a struggle against a dictatorship. This is a homegrown rebellion, and of course, all sorts of powers, both pro and anti-regime, will try to take advantage of it for their geopolitical interests. But let's not deny agency to the people of Syria.
And a listener named Dave says, how would it be possible at this point in time for Assad to transition out peacefully? By this point, wouldn't all of Syria and The Hague be crying for his head? I think that's a point well worth considering. Dawn writes, any plans for how the American middle class will pay for these interventions? I mean, as usual, listeners are coming up with questions that are quite pointed and important, and we'll go to more of your calls in just a minute. I want to read another email, though, but from Richard, who says, Syria has become Obama's Bosnia and Rwanda. He could have and should have taken out Assad early on with a missile or two without any repercussions. He should do it now. It's too bad he waited so long so that it's too late to determine who will control Syria when Assad is gone. But he will go. It's not too late to save another 100,000 lives if Obama still cares. But he doesn't, and he won't. And maybe he can give the rebels some grave-digging equipment. Let me bring on another caller, and that's you. Michael, good morning.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to say I appreciate the fact that your guests finally got to the point of the relationship between Syria and Israel, because that seems to be the crux of the issue. It seems like to me that if Syria was in some other part of the world, we probably would have gotten involved a lot sooner. And perhaps even a lot more intimately. But anyway, I just wanted to say that I appreciate it. Finally that you got to the elephant in the room. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let me go back to Professor Al-Azam. How much does Israel play into this whole picture, in your judgment?
Well, I don't think it plays as much as some people would like to think it does. I mean, obviously, the Israelis are concerned, and obviously, as the United States, we would have concerns about anything that might have a serious implication on the Israelis.
Excuse me, I don't think the Israelis know which horse to back in this, do they?
Well, you know, it depends on who you talk. And in my conversations with Israeli, you know, officials and such, we seem to get two sides. We, you know, from the military people, we seem to hear, and this is why I was not surprised that the Brigadier General issued the statement that he did. From the military side, they seem keen to support the departure of Assad. I remember meeting a senior Israeli intelligence officer general, in fact, a couple of years ago in Washington, and he basically said that Assad really was not good for Israel, and that his removal, anything that comes after Assad, would be better for Israel and Israel's security. I don't think that was necessarily a very widespread held opinion at the time, but I think it is increasing, and certainly amongst the military and the intelligence in Israel. But the civilian aspect, you know, Netanyahu's government here and those guys, they, I don't think they're quite convinced yet, but then they have political considerations as well. And that's why we seem to have this kind of conflicting, you know, we hear something from one side and then we hear something from the other. But certainly in private, when we talk to the Israelis, they would rather see Assad go, and they would be more than happy to you know, even help out if they could, but obviously they can't.
Let me hear from another caller. And Brian, that's you. Join us. Thanks for waiting.
Yes. I don't believe that there could be any political solution. For both sides, it's victory or death, and Assad can't win against the Syrian people. It's only how long will it take? My question is, I don't understand why the experts and the pundits don't talk about why doesn't the United States or NATO bomb the airstrips so that the airplanes can't take off. If the United States or NATO bomb the airstrips, it would be over in 2 weeks.
Let me take that question. We're coming up on the close of the hour here. Gregory Koblenz, let me go to you.
Just to go back to the issue of chemical weapons, which we started the show off with. Now, having read the letter that the White House sent to Congress, it's not clear the Syrians have run across the red line that Obama laid out. There's a lot of hedging in the U.S. assessment of what actually has happened in Syria. There's no definitive...
The red line is shifting. I'm just wondering what you think about the idea of hitting airstrips, because that's what the caller asked, as a tactic, as a strategy.
I think that starts you down a slippery slope, and so unless you make a fundamental decision that you want to change the regime in Syria and commit whatever resources necessary, it doesn't make sense to make that symbolic of a military act, which really won't have that big of an impact.
We'll have to let it stand there. We are at the end of the hour. Thank you, Gregory Koblenz from the Council on Foreign Relations, Stephen Zunis from University of San Francisco, and Amaral Azam from Shawnee State, and Deborah Amos from NPR. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.